Good morning. I'm going to shift gears slightly here and talk about this partnership, but in order to do that, the partnership between physics and engineering, which has persisted for 46 years, as a matter of fact, I see many of the engineers here in this audience, I'm going to use as a vehicle to talk about that a description of some of the devices that John did not describe, some of the controllers that are wrapped around those devices, and then lastly, I'm going to talk a bit about some spin-offs, and I'm just going to touch on this. There have been an enormous number of spin-offs in this project, so I'm going to have to restrict myself to just some of my favorites. I'm going to acknowledge the engineers here, and John acknowledged some of the physicists. In particular, Dan DeBray is in the audience, our co-PI. Bill Benzie was responsible for the electrostatic suspension system. Bill Reeve from Lockheed Martin, who was one of our heroes, did a great job for us. And then we also have some alumni here in the form of Greg Gute and Rob Brumley, postdocs who helped us in an enormous way. Marshall Center also brought engineering talent to bear on this program, and it was essential to what we did in many areas. We had support from other individuals that I'm not going to mention. And of course, we've been funded and supported by NASA for a very long time, and we are indebted and thank them very much for that support. Now, this chart is going to get the record as the most frequently shown chart in this whole conference. Just a reminder for those of you that have never seen it before, we are measuring the tiny deflections predicted by general relativity, and we actually do it with four gyros. I'm not certain that we would have passed Einstein's test because I'm not certain in the beginning this idea sounded as absurd as it really was. And I say that because of the technology that was needed to actually pull this off. I think anyone that had that insight of 40 years or so would have perhaps said the idea is a little absurd. But meanwhile, we pulled it off. And John has talked to you about the aspects associated with the payload. I'm going to move out just a little bit and talk about the more of the spacecraft and interactions. Short history, the project was conceived by Leonard Schiff, the head of the physics department, a theoretical physicist. He conceived that back in 1959, and in that era, there was an exercise program. I'm not making this up. At Stanford, in which at noon, professors and some students would go over and swim in a outdoor pool. The outdoor pool had one interesting feature. It was all male because everyone swam without any clothes on. And as a consequence, Schiff, who puzzled after he developed the idea, wanted to find out whether it was a practical idea. And there was an important meeting of three naked professors. Bob Cannon, an engineer with a background in inertial navigation guidance and gyros, and Bill Fairbank, a very famous and, in our opinion, revered professor, experimental physicist with a lot of knowledge about cryogenics. And they concluded that, yes, indeed, it was something that was feasible. And as a result, we have had this partnership for 46 years. I'd like to remind you, John has already emphasized it, that one of the underlying philosophies is this philosophy of near zero. Drive disturbances and measurement errors as close to zero as you can. But we don't stop there. There's one other thing that is done, and I'm going to show you a few examples of it. We take advantage of natural averaging. An example, of course, is the roll of the spacecraft about the line of sight to the star. We try to take advantage of that because of a number of reasons that I'm going to highlight, but it helps with both errors and disturbances. So here I'm going to introduce three unique devices, unique to us. The microthrusters, I'm going to be talking more about those. They capture the boil-off of the helium gas and use it to our great benefit. The mass trim mechanism, you probably have not heard about this. This helps drive the cross products of inertia of the spacecraft to near zero so that we can control its pointing direction with this tiny thruster. And lastly, as an example, the GPB suspension system. This is the ensemble for a single gyro. So the topics for the talk are the control capabilities, which are enabled by those micro thrusters, and we call that, in our parlance, engineering parlance, it's a sixth degree of freedom controller. It's first time ever done on a spacecraft actively, and by that we mean three axes of attitude and three axes of position. all of which are controlled by our thrusters. I'm also going to talk about the gyro suspension system and show how it worked. It is extremely notable because of its working range of over 100 million. It's essential for measuring both the gyro position, which we use in a number of our controllers, and as well for centering those gyros, actually controlling them, and there's some value in doing that. And then the last thing I'm going to talk about is something I call Einstein's landing system, a little bit exaggerated perhaps, but I hope you'll enjoy that aspect as well. So here we are with this famous gyro chart. I call it a double logarithmic chart because the labels are at every 100 units rather than 10 units, and that just draws your attention to the fact that an electrically suspended gyro on Earth calibrated can perhaps do 10 to the minus 5, and we measure that in degrees per hour. I'll calibrate you on that in a minute. What we're trying to measure is the geodetic and frame dragging precessions predicted, and you can see that on the ground, with the very best gyros, it's hopeless. On the other hand, with the GPB gyro, somewhere down in this region, it is certainly very feasible, and we should be able to do it fairly accurately. We point out this is a milliarc second per year. For those of you who have forgotten what a milliarc second is, if I take a dime and look at it intently from Los Angeles, from the top side of the dime to the bottom, that is a milliarc second, and that's what we're trying to measure, a very small quantity indeed. And then to calibrate you a bit on drift rates, 10 to the minus 10, which is well above what we really need, or it's not as good as what we need, is actually a drift rate equivalent to 1 degree in about 10,000 centuries. So we're talking very tiny angles and very, very small drift rates. Now, John's view of this problem is this is a manufacturing problem in terms of the classic Newtonian mass unbalanced drifts. And he showed you something about the delta R and the little specific lift force and the fact if they're not lined up, you have a problem. You can go through the equations. The drift rate is the torque divided by the gyroscopic stiffness. The torque is given by the mass times this specific force times delta R, moment of inertia well known. It all comes down to this, that the delta R over R requirement is to be less than this, most of which is dictated by our ability to spin up the gyro, but the important thing is this little F. So John's problem is, I want to make delta R over R very small. Our problem is we want to make F very small, and it's the combination of those two things that really makes this work, because you can't manufacture a delta R over R if F is 1G. It's hopeless, a part of a proton. If you are in a standard satellite, the drag is usually on the order of 10 to the minus 8 Gs, depending upon the mass divided by the coefficient of drag in the area, but even there, not likely that you could ever manufacture it, but now we get back to our so-called drag-free system in which we think we can achieve a specific force of 10 to the minus 11 G on the cross-track average, and now we can manufacture such a gyro. As a matter of fact, the requirement is here, and we actually achieve that. So I'm going to focus on the other side. I'm going to focus on the side that John kind of swept under the rug, not deliberately. He was waiting for me to talk about it. And that is how we achieve this specific force. Fundamentally, this is an idea where we are chasing the number 3 gyro with the whole spacecraft. So we never touch the spacecraft. The interactions are very, very small. The other gyros have to still be centered and against gravity gradient and perhaps some small local gravitation. So I'm going to focus on that. So in terms of the control goals, I'm just going to show you a few of them. We want to control this drag free to the 10 to the minus 11. We want to have the other gyros all centered. And then we're going to use this notion of natural averaging. But that also places some control demands on us. We'd like to control the initial orbit plane of the satellite such that it contains both the guide star and the spin axis of the Earth. And we do that both to separate the two effects and also to average gravity gradient. We want to control the spacecraft rolling to be phase locked, not just frequency, but phase, so there's no cumulative error, to about 20 arc seconds. And that helps us in averaging those torques, that delta R over F, and reduces the squid 1 over F noise and helps us with the temperature. We're kind of barbecuing all the boxes on the outside fairly rapidly, and their temperature stays uniform. We want to control each gyro spin axis to initially point at the star. And I'm not going to go into the details. Bill Benzie invented and demonstrated how we did that, and it worked very well on orbit. And we'd also like to control our DC suspension system such that it flips signs. So if there's any bias in those two voltages, they get averaged. It's much like you do in the old days with analog amplifiers, where you flip both the input and the output. So these are some of the things that I'm going to use as a vehicle to talk about the control and the engineering contributions. Here's our spacecraft. And the important features for this talk are, first of all, 16 helium gas thrusters, very small thrust capability, 0 to 10. There is no minus 10. They can't suck. They can only blow. And we have here the little thruster clusters. There are usually two or three of them on each of these, I guess. And you don't see all of them. But at any rate, that gives us our 6 degree of freedom control. The roll star sensors, the mass trim mechanism to tune the moments of inertia. It's actually 7 of them. Only 2 are shown there. And then the Stanford modified global positioning system that's used for precise orbit information. And we also did some research on other things that you can do with it. Other things that spacecraft people love and have to worry about, I'm not going to talk about. And I think there'll be a storyboard on this. I would encourage you, if you're interested, to go by and look into that. So here are a few of the control problems or challenges that we had. I've included the degrees of freedom here. Pointing at the guide star, we'd like to do that in inertial space to 20 milliarc seconds in a certain bandwidth. The drag-free gyros, this is the cross-axis, getting the other gyros centered, the spacecraft roll being phase-locked, the initial orbit to 500 meters from the pole or better, getting the axis of maximum inertia so that we can not be fighting the natural motion of the spacecraft, but instead have the thruster simply trimming things out, and then the spacecraft center of mass. Now, the point of this chart, as much as anything else, is to show where these little teeny thrusters that were invented initially by Dan DeBray, where they fit in. And the micro thrusters are used for pointing at the guide star. They're used for the drag-free gyro. They're used for the roll phase lock, the initial orbit, and their demand is used to adjust that. They are at the heart of what we do as a actuator, actually. The other devices, the gyro suspension system you see showing prominently up here, the GPS system, and the mass trim mechanism. So these devices I selected because I thought that they were illustrative of what we've been doing. So here are the thrusters. Controls the cross-axis to tiny fraction of an inch. Again, it was pioneered by Dan and actually flown in 1972 on a transit navigation satellite. So the technology had been demonstrated, although not in this form. And I have to give a lot of credit to Lockheed Martin, who actually took the idea and engineered it into these devices. What is unusual about the thrusters is they're not on-off. They are continuous proportional thrusters. Again, they can only push, I guess you would say. But they can't go negative, of course, so you've got to worry a little bit about how you handle that, and we did that quite well. Here is a thruster. You can see the cutaway. It captures in a plenum the helium gas that comes out here, and there's a sort of a loudspeaker device that wiggles this valve, allows the gas to come out through this tiny valve, and we get our thrust. Now, as you sit there listening to my talk, you might just breathe out. When you do, it turns out you're about 100 times higher than the thrust level coming out of this device. So you have some idea that we're talking extremely fine forces. This is a very nice piece of work done by Lockheed that measures the actual performance of this thruster, showing, first of all, very linear characteristic, but also its specific impulse 130 seconds, quite close to its theoretical value of 156. You also note, if you're a fluid dynamics kind of person, we're talking Reynolds numbers of 10. No, I didn't say 10,000, I said 10. Very interesting design indeed, and candidly, Dan is the one that should be talking about it. Mass trim mechanism, a large, Ken Laurel, I think, did this nod first, didn't he? I think he was the one that did the first thesis on this. But this is a large tungsten mass with a worm drive screw. It was conceived at Stanford, but the actual device was manufactured by Lockheed Martin. So how did we do? Well, here's the launch. The first item on the page is we have to come fairly close to that initial orbit and then use our little microthrusters for about 30 to 60 days to figure out whether we are in the right orbit or not. This was a very nice television picture that we saw sitting in the blockhouse, because it shows the separation and it shows that all four of the solar panels had released. Well, the good news was we never had to use it. We didn't have to trim the orbit. The orbit was so good in the beginning that we were close to 100 meters near the pole and against a 500 meter requirement, no problem. We had the capability but didn't need it. Now, suspension system. The gyro suspension system, I claim, has schizophrenic requirements. And I'm saying that for the following reason. On the one hand, you don't want to disturb the gyro in any way. You want to minimize the torques, have very slow, soft responses, minimize the electromagnetic interference, and work on this zero force as carefully and cautiously as you can. On the other hand, we've got a little spinning bomb inside called a gyroscope. And if that gyroscope ever touches the side of its housing at roughly 5,000 RPM, we're going to have some real trouble. And so dropping it is, you may not be able to quite read this, but the idea is don't let the rotor crash. So in addition to the suspension that is acting very softly, we have to have an oversight god looking in on this and measuring the probability that we're going to hit the side. And if we're going to come even close, we've got to jump in there with a really heavy suspension voltage and hang on for dear life. And of course, the whole thing has to be compatible with space. This is a block diagram of the system developed by Bill Benzie and manufactured by Lockheed Martin. I'm not going to go through the details. I'll point out that one of the keys is the position bridges. They are, in essence, capacitive bridges. They have to be very low noise and quite stable. But those are the device that keeps track of what's going on. Normally, we're operating on sort of this lower column, doing everything very softly. But the oversight function is constantly in place. And should anything go wrong, we come in there instead of with 5 volts, with perhaps 50 volts to hang on to things. And this shows the range. This shows the specific force maximum capability here at 1G, 10 meters per second squared, and down here, 10 to the minus 8 G, or 10 to the minus 7 meters per second squared. And the voltage range, force goes as the square of this voltage. It also shows that we have to be able to accommodate some kind of nominal 3 sigma meteorite hit and grab the spacecraft if we have to. We did not have to do that. Here's an example of how it worked, and I think it's kind of fun to look at it. I have a whole new dimension here. This is called a half a hair. We actually, the clearance inside is actually a half a hair, or more or less, depending on how kinky your hair is, I guess. But this shows an initial position. These are 3 axes. I don't know which one is red. But initially, the rotor was sitting against this red negative stop. It got suspended. It locked right in there. Then we let it loose in characteristic parabolic motion. It came down and did a 3-axis hit. You can see all 3 hits. Bounced again and again. Given the dimension and the cleanliness of the data, you say that the readout system looked pretty darn good. And again, it was I think the skill of Bill Benzie and his crew that designed all this. This shows another picture. Here's the gravity gradient acceleration with drag-free off. And here comes the drag-free controller. This is acceleration in nanogs, and so well below 10 nanogs is what's left. This shows the modulation of that gravity gradient with orbital. And it also shows the noise floor in the measurement. It's about 1 silicon atom. And the point is, we really know where this gyro is. This is also sort of an interesting diagram, I think. This shows accelerations, and it shows the segmentation between what those little thrusters are absorbing. Notice this is a logarithmic scale, of course. Here's what the thrusters were doing as a function of frequency, and here's what the gyro itself, the residual suspension, was doing. So this is the control effort of the space vehicle, and here's the control effort of the gyro. And you can see that we indeed have achieved zero G. Now, for the next brief subject, I'd like to point out again this chart. This is the second most famous chart in our conference here. This is the chart of the squid amplitude noise versus frequency, and it shows characteristic 1 over F. So if we were at zero frequency, we would have to absorb or account for somehow these sets of noises. By rolling the spacecraft, we force ourselves out here and, in essence, push ourselves into a region that has acceptable noise. John talked about that. The point here is that it is the precision of that roll that helps us do that. And here is, again, the ubiquitous thruster, the star sensors, and the gyroscope readout 1 over F noise is being reduced. How well did this work? Well, we wanted 20 arc seconds during the time we're taking data, and that would be about between there and there. And here is our data taking time on both sides. Both star trackers, B minus A, is down here, and it shows that indeed that met its goal. The other last thing in the pointing area is the vehicle pointing itself. And this is data, and indeed it met its 20 milliarc second requirement. The other controller is the controller that we use GPS for. This is the antenna patterns of the four antennas that we had for GPS, a very unique GPS set that was modified by Stanford. Two fully redundant sets, a receiver and four antennas. We take lots of data, and the question is, how well did it do? The requirement was 25 meters. 7.5 centimeters per second velocity, and what it actually did was about an order of magnitude or more better than that. So indeed, the GPS set worked quite well. And then I challenged one of my students. I said, we have all these antennas, and you're measuring with great accuracy. Is there a possibility that you could measure attitude by measuring the differences in the carrier phase of these signals as they came in? And his name was Clark Cohen. And indeed, he said he could do that, and he manufactured something that leads to the subject of spin-offs. Because why does everything happen? Well, one thing leads to another. So what we did is, and I'm going to talk about a number of, I'm just going to touch on the spin-offs. Precision machining, including optical contacting, is a major spin-off. The porous plug that allows us to use helium in space and not blow the helium out, just let the gas out. The electromagnetic field is certainly a spin-off, and I've talked about the drag-free and pointing technologies, but I'd like to focus down here on these last two items. We took the device that was manufactured by Clark and put it on an airplane. Here are the four antennas, and we wanted to measure how well GPS could provide us attitude under actual dynamic conditions. And I'm not going to show you all the data, but the point is, very, very well. These are violent roll maneuvers. If you've ever been in an airplane going 60 degrees to 60 degrees, this is, go find a small bag because you're probably going to need it. This shows the difference between the inertial measurement unit and the system developed by Clark Cohen. And then I said, well, look, if you can measure to a centimeter, if it's possible to do that same differential measurement to something on the ground, maybe you have a landing system. And sure enough, one thing led to another. And this is a 737 that the FAA kindly provided to us. The errors here on landing, plus or minus 1 feet, foot is there. We had it tracked by lasers that said they had this accuracy, but clearly it was a lot better. And this is actually 110 straight successes, typical errors of 4 inches. And this, in turn, has led to a major program at FAA for completely Cat 3 landings using GPS. Again, the heritage, Gravity Probe B, research. And we took that same device, put it in a farm tractor. The rest is kind of history here. We showed you could robotically, hands-off, control a farm tractor to about 3 inches on a rough field, moving at a speed about as fast as you can run. You wouldn't want to go any faster because you're starting to get your, you need a kidney belt. I've been in when we're doing this. It's sort of exciting. This has led to a business that now is about $100 million a year. All the really smart farmers in California are using it. And that brings me to my conclusion. I think that this partnership between engineering and physics has been essential to what we do, and I, speaking for the engineers, we certainly enjoyed it. It's been a lot of fun, a great ride, and it's not over, and I expect every success from that. A lot of the critical components, controllers, all of them have met the goals, and these devices also are going to enable a whole new generation of experiments, in my opinion. And the spin-offs are not surprising, but frequently the spin direction is a little surprising. So, and here are some of the wonderful people who've worked on it. Apologies to anyone whose face is not on it. And that concludes my talk. The key is that inside the spacecraft is a gyro, and that gyro is not being levitated. It is just free to move, unless it gets moving too far and then we grab it, but it's free to move. So what the thrusters are doing is forcing the whole spacecraft to chase this shielded gyroscope or proof mass as it goes around in orbit, and that's frankly the key. So to me, it's amazing. And I say amazing because you've got a half a hair, literally, of clearance in there. And we're controlling it to a lot better than that. So in terms of a pure gravity orbit, it's pretty close to that. You have to worry about self-gravitation, a few things like that. But yes, sir?
Why do you call it cross-track? It seems like it's long term.
Well, no, it's the cross to the spin axis of the gyros that counts. Any forces in this direction can't produce a torque. Yes, sir.
Can you speak to how the interaction with engineers, how you get them over their initial ecophobia, where you know they basically you tell them your experiment, they laugh, and you have to get them to the point where that zero.
Well, I don't know. It's a good question. I think that the answer to that lies in these two gentlemen sitting here. They've been partners for 45 years, and that's Dan DeBray and Francis Everett. And I think we were fortunate that we had someone, you can shut your ears, Dan. We had someone like Dan who one of his other expertise is precision machining. He wasn't scared of lots of zeros, I don't think. And as a result, the Aeroastro Department, which does spacecraft at Stanford, became heavily involved. My dissertation was on a version of this gyro working for this professor back in 1964 to 66. And then I went away and finally came back as a professor in 84. But there's just been a history. But incidentally, it's self-serving. How many PhDs in engineering? 49 PhDs and some astonishing PhDs. I mean, really, for an engineer, sort of heart-wrenching stuff. So it's been a great ride, and you're seeing some examples. There's a few of our graduates here who've gone on to other things, but gee, their contributions were superb. Okay, thank you very much.